You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network.
This is James Altucher. I'm very happy to be here with Sam Harris, author of Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion. Sam, you've done like a million things, though, actually. Like, you're a neuroscientist, you're a philosopher, you seem to get into a lot of arguments with very famous people all the time, mm-hmm. and you've also wrote a big essay about lying. I'm sure I'm missing other things. You've traveled all around the world studying spirituality and meditation and all sorts of things. How's it going?
It's going well. It's colorful at the moment. I don't know if you've been following my recent collisions, but it's been an odd book tour, which I'm just winding down. But thank you for talking to me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me ask you about that. I do want to get into my main goal is I want to get people a feeling of how they can use the lessons you learned from waking up to improve their lives. But mm-hmm. I am very curious about, during the process of this book tour, obviously you've gotten into a lot of fights. And maybe, like, just what happened, like, so Ben Affleck on the Bill Maher show was, like, yelling at you. What happened there?
Well, you know, I don't actually know what happened there or what fully accounts for it. I mean, I know what its effects were, but the reality was, you know, I came onto the panel on that show, which, if your listeners don't know, is there's a mid-panel interview. There's a panel of three people, and there's a mid-panel interview where someone comes out and gets a protected 5 to 7 minutes of interview time with Bill, and then it gets opened up to the rest of the panel. So I stepped onto the show at that point, never having met Ben, and he immediately jumped into the middle of my supposedly protected interview with criticism, which was a very hostile act, and it was criticism of things I was saying apropos of my book, Waking Up. I was talking about, in this case, certain New Age beliefs that I found to be incredible, and so that the conversation hadn't actually turned to the topic of real controversy, which is the connection between Islam and terrorism, which then fully derailed the panel. But so he had it in his head that he was going to object to what I was saying already, but it was not really based on anything I was saying because we hadn't yet hit the hot topic, and he was already committed to interrupting the interview. So it was an odd encounter, which I broke down somewhat on my blog, but I don't actually know why he had that attitude going in.
Well, what were you saying about New Age beliefs at the time?
Well, I simply said that we know that it was so Bill had said something skeptical about, you know, why I would write a book on spirituality, and he didn't expect this from me, a famous so-called new atheist who has been criticizing religion for the last 10 years. And so I said, I just, by way of conceding part of his point, I said, yeah, you know, much of what people believe under the name of spirituality is every bit as incredible as what people believe under the rubric of religion. And then I said something like, if you're trading your belief in the virgin birth of Jesus for a belief in Atlantis, you haven't made much intellectual progress. And then Ben jumped in with something a little snide, you know, pushing back there. And that was the first indication that I wasn't going to be getting a lot of love from him on the panel. But it was the real bone he had to pick with me was on the topic of Islam and my criticism of that religion in particular. I mean, one of the taboos here that I keep running across is that it's really an article of faith among all secular liberals that all of our religions are equivalent. They're all equally wise, or they're equally empty, or they're equally benign, or they're equally irrelevant, but they're all equal in some way. And to criticize one more than any other, no matter what the context, is often conflated with bigotry. And that is just a totally irrational and ultimately dangerous bias to have, because our religions are different. Religion is one word. I've argued this in many contexts, as perhaps your listeners have heard this before, but it's the best analogy I've got. Religion is a word like sports. You know, we have sports like pro football and Thai boxing and MMA and free solo rock climbing. Those are all very different in and of themselves. Those are all dangerous, but only the first few were violent. Free rock climbing is not violent, but it's even more dangerous. But then you compare those sports to badminton and curling and other things that really don't pose much risk of injury or even require much athleticism in the case of curling. Then you realize that the word sports just names a totally diverse class of activities that if you want to talk about what people actually do and the kinds of risks they run while doing it, you have to talk in a more fine-grained way. You have to differentiate among sports. And the same is true of religion. And we're just lying to ourselves when we say that there is not some special link between the doctrine of Islam in this case and the kind of violence and oppression we see in the Muslim world. There is. It's explicit, and it's explicit in the minds of every jihadist and Islamist who's behaving this way. For the most part, liberals are asleep on this issue, and I say that with considerable frustration because I'm a liberal on every single question apart from this particular one, apparently.
Well, let me ask you a question, and I'm gonna reel it back just a second,
sure.
And then I'm gonna even reel it back further in a little bit. But the book itself, Waking Up, it seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong, you've been defined as what you call a new atheist, but it seems like what you're really doing is you're separating out religion as kind of a historical notion, like maybe it's been sort of perceived as science in the past or kind of nation building in the past or whatever. So there's this historical notion of religion and then spirituality, which is more of an inner experience we can use to get closer to some perceived or unperceived level of consciousness that allows us to live our lives better.
Yeah. The line I would put between spirituality and religion is the line of not making irrational claims about the nature of reality on the basis of your experience. So there are these extraordinary experiences that people have, and they want to have, and they should want to have them, because these are often the most important experiences anyone has. Experiences like unconditional love or self-transcendence or ecstasy or bliss. I mean, this is where life gets really, really good, when you start inhabiting states of consciousness like that. But what people have traditionally done, and what many people still want to do, is extrapolate from those experiences and make claims about the nature of the cosmos on the basis of them. So that, and this is obviously what traditionally religious people do. So if you're a Christian praying in church, and you feel just overwhelmed by unconditional love for all sentient beings all of a sudden, this is a thrilling experience. I would say it's ethically and psychologically exactly the sort of experience you want to have. It's certainly possible to have this experience. But a Christian will interpret it as proof of the doctrine of Christianity. It'll be proof that the Holy Ghost is visiting her, or that Jesus has taken an interest in her prayers, or something will hook up with the background belief in the truth of Christian doctrine, and this will seem like data in its favor. But of course, a Hindu praying to Shiva, or a Buddhist, or an atheist like myself, will have a very different interpretation. And what I'm arguing is that by virtue of those the sheer incompatibility of those interpretations, we know that there's a deeper principle at work. We know that this none of these experiences confirm any ancient doctrine about the divine origin of a specific book or the virgin birth of a specific person or anything else that people believe in the name of religion. And they don't confirm the kinds of New Age beliefs that many people want to replace religion with. So an experience of unconditional love doesn't tell you that love pervades the cosmos or that love was the energy that was here before the Big Bang or anything else spooky like that. But it does tell you about the possibilities of human experience and it tells you something about the human mind. It tells you something about the human brain, ultimately, if we study these states of consciousness neuroscientifically. So the connection between spirituality and science is not where many New Age types like Deepak Chopra want to put it, with spooky physics and quantum mechanics and cosmology. It's at neuroscience and psychology and any field that is seeking to answer questions about the nature of human experience.
Why do you think people want to connect the dots like that? Like, why does everything have to be, you know, it's sort of like the quest in physics for a unified theory. Why does there have to be kind of a, why do you think so many people want a religious unified theory? And the example I'm thinking of is, I saw an interview, I think, with you and the New York Times where the interviewer basically wanted to connect the dots and somehow bring science into the study of consciousness and asked you if that was what you were trying to do, where you said no. But why do you think that happens?
Well, I do agree that studying consciousness scientifically would be a wonderful thing to do. I just argue that there are conceptual problems reducing consciousness to a story of unconscious information processing in the brain or any other physical system. So that what many people want to do, and really the only point of purchase on studying consciousness scientifically, is to think of it in terms of being an emergent property out of, you know, brain chemistry in our case, but something that could potentially emerge based on any information processing in any physical system. So we might one day have conscious computers, et cetera. Now, I think that all of that is very interesting, and in fact, that may be the case. There are good reasons to believe that consciousness is, at some level, the product of what brains do, but the reality is that there's nothing about a physical brain looked at as a physical system that suggests the existence of consciousness. If we were not already conscious ourselves, we would have no sense that it exists anywhere. You look at a brain, and it's just, you know, there's just, even with all the behavior associated with it, even just a fully behaving human being with the brain at the center, nothing suggests consciousness except your own, the undeniable fact that you experience it yourself, and then you reason by analogy that other people must experience it. So the only proof of the reality of consciousness at this moment is consciousness. And no matter how much we correlate changes in our states, in our experience, with changes in the brain, as we do in a neuroimaging lab, this game of correlation, while incredibly interesting, and it produces a lot of fascinating science about the nature of human experience and the human mind, it doesn't properly reduce consciousness to a story of just neurotransmitters or information processing. You're still just comparing the subjective side with the objective side, or the first person side with the third person side. And many people are speaking as though if you did enough of this, well, then the first person side would just go away. Then we would just be able to talk about brains and neurotransmitters, or say, as Francis Crick once did, you know, you're nothing but a pack of neurons. That's actually illegitimate to do, because the cash value of correlating changes in the brain with changes in consciousness is always the change in consciousness. And if that change in consciousness wasn't happening, well, then this game of correlation would no longer make any sense.
Are you referring to like studies on like scientific studies on meditators, where it shows that different areas of the brain prove to be more active than compared with like non-meditators?
Yeah. Or to bring it back into an area where there's actually much more research. You take something like the experience of anxiety, for instance, or fear. Now, we know a lot about that in terms of its underlying mechanisms, neurophysiologically and hormonally. So you bring a terrified person into the lab, they're going to be this is going to be detectable in many outward ways as a physiological state. So they'll have sweating palms. So you'll have a change in galvanic skin response. Their amygdala in the center in the temporal lobe that is often active during high emotional states, but especially fear states. That'll show a response. They'll have high blood cortisol. All of these are quote objective or third person measures of fear and anxiety, but they are only measures of fear and anxiety because they've been reliably correlated with the experience. If half the people coming into the lab tomorrow who claim to feel intense anxiety did not have heightened cortisol and did not have a heightened amygdala response and did not have sweaty palms, well then these would no longer be good objective measures of these states. And so it's the reliability of the correlation is what has given us the sense that we can now talk about fear and anxiety in purely physiological or third-person terms.
Does it go the other way? Like if I'm calm and someone somehow artificially spikes my cortisol levels, will I suddenly start to feel terrified?
Yeah. And so there's a good causal story to be told about how your mental life is the product, in this case, of your physical life. But it's still true to say that part of the reality we're talking about, and I think in the case of consciousness, an irreducible part is the subjective side. It is totally coherent to say that there are systems that could behave exactly like human beings. Let's say some robot of the future that is as good as we are in every way, that may not be conscious. Which is to say, they'll pass the Turing test. They'll seem indistinguishable from a human mind. In fact, they might even seem superior to human minds. But there may be nothing that it's like to be that system. That may be true, and the converse is also true. That it's possible to have a system that does not seem conscious at all, that is in fact conscious and is having an inner experience that is undetectable from the outside. So this double dissociation proves that. That consciousness is not reducible to any of its outward signs. I had a friend who once woke up during a surgery for which he had had a general anesthetic, and he, because of the paralytic component of the anesthesia, he was unable to signal to his doctors that he was feeling more of the procedure than he cared to, which was, needless to say, inconvenient because they were in the process of replacing his liver. Oh. And so he's, this is a phenomenon called anesthesia awareness. Now, you take a moment to think about that problem. That cancels much of what has been said in philosophy in the last 100 years about the nature of consciousness. Anyone who thinks that what's important about consciousness conceptually is its link to speech and behavior, and that maybe things that can't speak or behave aren't in fact conscious, it's a crazy idea, which never should have been compelling to anyone, but it was. For much of the 20th century, that was a dominant view in Western philosophy.
Yeah, but I would say thinking also is a critical part of consciousness. So there, you could not speak and not behave, but still be conscious if you could think.
Yeah, well,
I'm not saying it's my view necessarily, but that is a view.
Yeah, well, one thing that meditation reveals, if you get into it in any depth, is that isn't true. That thinking is certainly not necessary for consciousness, even though most people spend all their time thinking. But thoughts arise in consciousness as objects of consciousness, and they arise and they pass away, and you can have experiences, especially if you get very concentrated in meditation, where thoughts are no longer arising, and that's the goal of certain practices of meditation. It's not really the goal of the most important practices, but it's concentration is a tool that, when you get it tuned up, allows you to have experiences where thoughts aren't arising, and those are incredibly pleasant states of consciousness.
So I think meditation also is a term kind of like how you were using sports before, where it's like this umbrella for many different kind of religious practices of thinking or concentration or whatever. Like certainly some types of Tibetan meditation is very different from some types of Zen meditation, and you refer to Advaita Vedanta meditation. Mm-hmm. What type of meditation or mindfulness or whatever you want to call it would you recommend for basically separating out the thoughts from the consciousness? Because I think that's in practice the one that could be recommended for easing the fears or anxieties of someone who has that tendency.
Yeah. Well, I certainly would recommend mindfulness to everyone as the starting point. And mindfulness is a kind of awareness that is recommended in a tradition of Buddhist practice called Vipassana. And Vipassana is the Pali word for insight. And this comes from the oldest tradition of Buddhism, the Theravada. And mindfulness now has been exported from Buddhism, and you find it more or less everywhere. It's in clinical practice. It's in psychological and neuroscientific research. And it's really, there's no accident that that's so. Mindfulness is, unlike almost any other style of meditation, perfectly packaged for export to secular culture because it doesn't entail believing anything on insufficient evidence, and it doesn't entail adding anything strategically to your experience by way of practice. So you don't have to say a mantra, you don't have to visualize anything, you don't have to develop any kind of fondness for the iconography of Buddhism or any other religion. Mindfulness is just a mode of paying very clear attention to your experience in the present moment. So to notice whatever it is, in fact, you do notice in each moment. So the sensation, the mere sensation of breathing or of shifting in your seat, or the next sound that impinges on your eardrum, or the next thought that arises in awareness, or the next mood or feeling that you notice. And so you're just witnessing the flow of experience.
It's this noticing aspect that's extremely important. So instead of saying, I'm nervous, I notice I'm nervous, or I notice I'm feeling nervous, there's kind of this distancing that happens.
Yeah, but it becomes a non-conceptual awareness where it's not so much distancing, but it's you're no longer thinking about experience, you're just experiencing it in its non-conceptual state. So for instance, something like nervousness, mindfulness would be the mode of paying more, even closer attention to the sensations of nervousness, so that you feel them just as pure energy in the body. I mean, just you no longer think about why you're nervous. You no longer think about how you can stop being nervous. You simply let thoughts come and go, but pay clear attention. It's a willingness to feel whatever it, in fact, you do feel in each moment. So and you'll notice it once you try to do that much of your thinking about experiences like nervousness is just a resistance to feeling them. The moment you're anxious, you're busy thinking about all the reasons why you are anxious and don't want to be anxious and wish you wouldn't have been anxious, and you're having a conversation with yourself that is a symptom of you're feeling that it's a problem to feel anxious. But if you're simply willing to just feel anxious and let anxiety arise as a physiological state and experience it in its raw form, it can be quite liberating because it has no meaning. It has no philosophical meaning or really psychological meaning. And when you're just encountering it as pure energy, it's like indigestion. You wouldn't walk, let's say you have to give a speech and your stomach hurts. Well, that's your stomach hurts, but that you wouldn't read so much meaning into it in the way that you do if you feel anxious while having to give the speech. And yet these are just sensations, and mindfulness is a way of, in a very non-judgmental mode, becoming aware of whatever arises in each moment without grasping at what's pleasant or pushing away what's unpleasant. But as you point out, the crucial distinction between meditating and failing to meditate, or being mindful and failing to be mindful, is the difference between being lost in thought or being clearly aware of what's arising in your experience, including the arising of thought.
Well, it's interesting. So a lot of, there's a lot of focus on mindfulness, and sometimes people say be aware of what you're doing now. Like you're even suggesting being aware of either the breath or the sounds that you're hearing or whatever is experiencing in your head. And you're differentiating this from sometimes, I mean, I'm sure you've had this experience where you're driving a car and then suddenly you're home and you can't even remember like the path, like how did I get here? So how do you, sometimes people just daydream. And what's the difference between, let's say, mindfulness and kind of, and what's the pros and cons, say, of mindfulness versus simply just spacing out?
They're quite distinct. And we spend more or less every waking moment lost in thought. And being distracted by thought is what mindfulness is cutting through. I mean, the enemy of mindfulness is to be distracted by thought, to be thinking without knowing that you're thinking, to have a thought arise and simply commandeer your awareness so that you are just your subjectivity is totally trimmed down by the contents and implications of that thought. So if it's an angry thought or a self-critical thought or a worried thought, you are just angry or self-critical or worried, and there's no space. You're not noticing thoughts arise as thoughts. You're not noticing them pass away. You're just busy thinking. And that, in fact, and the primary illusion born of that process is to feel that there is a thinker of thoughts, that you feel like a self that is having the thoughts and even authoring the thoughts. And that is the in terms of the goal of mindfulness is to cut through that illusion, this illusion that we have a separate self riding around inside our heads that is a thinker of thoughts and a feeler of feelings and an experiencer of experience. And that is something that if you pay close enough attention to, once you have the ability to pay attention through a practice like mindfulness, that can be disconfirmed. You can actually look closely enough at this thing you're calling yourself and find it to be absent. And that's a very freeing experience. I mean, it's one I talk about in the book under the description of self-transcendence. It's that, and this is something that people experience in a wide variety of ways, not necessarily through meditation. They have just glimpses of it because, in fact, this is just true of the nature of consciousness. It's possible to, through sports or music or sex or extreme experience, getting hit on the head, whatever, it's possible to have your experience perturbed in such a way that you notice that consciousness itself doesn't feel like I or me. In fact, what we call I and me are appearances in consciousness, and consciousness is a prior context. And again, I'm not saying anything spooky about the relationship between consciousness and the physical universe there. I'm just saying that the self doesn't even make sense from a neurological perspective. We know there's no place in our brain for the ego to be hiding. There's no one place in the brain where everything comes together for a unitary self that is unchanging from one moment to the next. All there is in the brain are processes that can be interrupted or modified to various degrees, and our conscious lives are a stream of a process, but most of us walk around feeling like we are like a boat, bobbing on the waters of consciousness that's unchanging, just being carried along, but there is no boat, there's just the stream, and meditation is a way of recognizing that.
And what would you say for yourself personally, or for even the listeners, what are some of the external benefits of being mindful? Like, for instance, some people might habitually daydream happy thoughts all day long.
Yeah.
As opposed to thoughts of terror or anxiety.
Right, right. Well, yeah, and that may be the case. Some of our listeners may just think happy thoughts all day long and interesting ones, but if they're anything like me, it's quite different than that. It's like that you've been kidnapped by the most boring person on earth and forced to have the same conversation over and over again. We'll say the same things to ourselves 15 times in a row, and it seems normal to us. which is peculiar because if you imagined your thoughts broadcast on a monitor for everyone else to hear, they would seem quite crazy for you to be rehearsing conversations in your head and saying what you should have said or would have said or could have said over and over again to yourself as though it's fresh each time. We just never get bored with our thoughts, apparently. But they are strangely boring and repetitive. And meditation is a way of breaking that spell, and it's a way of interrupting these often very unpleasant emotions that lead to speech and behavior that significantly complicates our lives. So, for instance, if you experience anger, the difference between mindfulness and never having heard of the concept is the difference between, or may very well be the difference between being angry just for a few moments and doing nothing about it, not saying anything that you'll later regret or doing anything that you'll later regret, and being angry for days or weeks or months at a time and acting on the basis of that emotion. But the reality is that if you pay very close attention to the arising of a mental state like anger and the arising of the thoughts that seem to justify it, you can't stay angry for more than a few moments at a time. It's not possible to stay angry for hours and much less days or weeks without thinking about the basis of your anger, without knowing that you're thinking, without being lost in thought, which is to say without being unmindful of your experience.
Right. Well, I kind of find, like, so for myself, when I'm angry, I'll often think of imaginary arguments with the person I'm angry at, and that's almost like a vehicle to keep the anger going.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it very much is. It is the thing that it is the way you would keep it going in those next moments. It's just because if you were not identified with those thoughts, if you just saw the thought arise and pass away, and the energy of anger arise in your body and begin to diminish, it would then diminish. It would just fall away. It's just the only way to stay angry for that next minute is to be thinking about, is to be having this fight in your head or thinking about the thing that he or she did to you or whatever it is that is telling you you have a reason to be angry in the first place.
And so you're stating that this process of mindfulness of kind of sitting there and noticing the thoughts as they arise, or practicing that, because I assume you start from a point where it's difficult and it gets easier and easier with practice, that this will kind of short circuit that attempt to keep the anger going, as an example.
Yeah. It gives you a tool. At minimum, it gives you a tool to decide how long you want to be angry for. Because I'm not saying that it's never appropriate to get angry, and I'm not saying that anger is never useful. There are situations in which I think you do want the energy of anger, and it is appropriate to even express anger or act from that very energized state against something that's, certainly something that's aggressively trying to harm you, say. But the question is, how long do you want to be lost in it? How long do you want to feel that way? And you can choose to cease to feel that way if you see the mechanism that is delivering this experience in each moment.
I mean, in general, I would argue that just for decision making, better to have kind of a some degree of control over your anger and fear and whatever neurosis you have to make better decisions in life.
Oh yeah, I totally agree. And anything that requires actual decision making, I think you want to have cooled down for it. But I'm thinking of situations where, in a self-defense situation, where someone is, your life is in danger, and you have the energy of anger or fear, kind of mobilizing your response. In my view, that's not the moment to be mindful and try to deflate this energy, because it could be very useful in that situation. And I think even on the level of speech, I think there are times where it's appropriate to convey anger to someone. I'm not really a yeller or anything, but I think it's appropriate to be motivated by a feeling of outrage when something that has been done is truly outrageous. So it's truly just a sign of a kind of callousness that is causing harm in the world that deserves to have outrage directed at it. And, whether that's in writing or in speech. So I'm not advocating a kind of blandness to our the way we show up in the world, where we're so desiccated by detachment that we can't express any kind of a passion, whether positive or negative, for different outcomes. I think that's and that is arguably a liability of a Buddhist framing of these issues. I think there's a kind of quietism that you get from the full Buddhist message that is politically unhelpful, and I think in many cases personally unhelpful. But that's a subtlety that we might not want to get into.
Well, it is interesting because you mentioned two different types of, let's just call it, fight or flight response. One is you're in the jungle and there's a lion there, so better to run than to sit there and be mindful of the fear. So that's kind of this evolutionary response. The other one, which I'll take an extreme, you're sitting in front of the computer and someone criticizes you, and we still feel this fight or flight response, but we're just staring at a computer. We're not actually fighting or running. And then I think even though you might still feel that sense of outrage, mindfulness is probably more called for in those situations.
Yeah, I would agree that 99 times out of 100, there's certainly no rush to respond to what has happened to you online. And
if you don't respond, it might be better. I'm wondering your specific opinion on, like, so you have stated like various opinions on Islam, and other people have taken your quotes out of context and called you, you know, all sorts of names, and then you've responded to that. Sometimes I wonder if what happens if you just don't respond to these people.
Yeah. Well, I've experimented with that, and it's. I can tell you what happens, and it's because that is the line I've taken for months and even years at a time, and that's the line I can't help but take in general, because there's just too much to respond to. Yeah, you know, we're talking about a fire hose of disingenuous and malicious criticism that I'm standing at the business end of more or less all the time. It's quite amazing, and because in my work I touch a lot of hot button issues that cause me to go against the grain of certain taboos, and I'm kind of an equal opportunity offender, because I criticize all religion, but I criticize religion differently, and so some of the things I say, you know, align with conservatives, and some things I say align with liberals, and so I do get it from both sides. But in terms of not responding, what happens is these things just, they're indelible online. You know, I'll give you one very concrete example, which I still have never been able to get out from the under the shadow of. So there's a paragraph in The End of Faith, my first book, where I talk about the problem of Islamic extremism, specifically with respect to nuclear proliferation, and what would it be like to have a regime that is essentially the psychological equivalent of the 19 hijackers, or of Al Qaeda, or people who really believe in paradise and really mean it when they say we love death more than the infidels love life, and these are people who are not bluffing. They are people who are eager to be martyred. These are the same sorts of people who would blow themselves up on a bus, but now they have long-range nuclear weapons. Well, so I asked us to think about this scenario, and I said that more than anyone else, the Muslim world has to think about this scenario and realize that this completely erodes the basis of a Cold War of the sort we had with the Soviet Union. There is no mutually assured destruction deterrence there with people who are eager to die. I mean, that was the difference. What we did not have with the Soviet Union were a group of aspiring martyrs, you know, for all of their faults. We had people who actually still wanted to live. And that was what made it a Cold War sustainable. So what I said there in this, and again, this is just one paragraph in my work, I said, we are meandering into a situation that is quite terrifying, where it's possible, based on our own ineptitude and based on the blindness on both sides, that we could find ourselves in a world where we have an Iran or Pakistan or some other regime that is just a coup away from having the true religious maniacs in charge, and they could have long-range nuclear weapons, which is to say, you know, missiles armed with nuclear warheads that could reach Europe and America. That situation would be a situation where we would have no rational option. We may have no rational option to launch our first strike of our own, given that we won't be able to destroy all these weapons conventionally, and we won't necessarily know where they are, et cetera. And I describe this as a horrible crime that must be avoided at all costs, because it would kill tens of millions of people. And this is something we absolutely have to avoid. But we have to talk honestly about the way that the true belief in martyrdom just runs roughshod over this notion of nuclear deterrence. So that was the message. Now, unscrupulous people like Chris Hedges, who used to be a journalist apparently, took that message and summarized it as Sam Harris calls for a nuclear first strike on the entire Muslim world. You know, they painted me as a genocidal maniac who wants today to kill hundreds of millions of Muslims because I'm so unhinged by my fear of Islam.
And after that, you said that, did Muslims themselves either attack you or defend you?
This has been repeated ad nauseum everywhere, and I mean, there's almost no comment thread associated with my work on any topic. It could be an interview about meditation, and I will see a comment if for masochistic reasons decide to read any of the comments. I now rarely do, but I will see a comment from someone who's saying, why would I want to learn meditation from a guy who wants to commit a nuclear genocide against Muslims?
It's sort of like there's a law on the internet called Godwin's Law, where the law is every argument on a message board, eventually somebody accuses the other person of being Hitler.
Well, no, it's different from that, because this is I think Godwin's Law is actually also harmful, because there are certain comparisons to the Nazis that are valid. I mean, the fact that we think everyone has by definition lost an argument the moment they reference the Nazis is also a problem. I mean, you have to be able to talk about, I mean, there are things that are very Nazi-like in our world, and to say that, and I mean, it's just a fact now in public debate on almost any topic that if you reference Hitler or reference the Nazis, you're perceived by a significant percentage of the audience to be speaking in hyperbole and to therefore have lost your argument. But it's not always the case. And again, this is like a shorthand way of thinking that I think is harming our discourse. But no, in this case, this is just a frank and malicious and conscious misrepresentation of my views that has gained traction, that is impossible. I mean, once you get slimed by something like this, it's almost impossible to correct for it. For years I've had a blog post on my or an article on my website entitled "Response to Controversy," and in fact, I think it's still the number one Google result for the phrase "response to controversy" is this article on my website, where I go through each of these things that I have been falsely accused of. And try to I offer a fuller discussion of what my views actually are on that topic. But this is the kind of thing that happens to you when you criticize. Strangely, it's happening more on the left now, which is incredibly depressing. The kinds of skirmishes I have on the left are far more frustrating, and I hesitate to say this, but I really think it's true, intellectually dishonest than the kinds I have with, Bible thumpers on the right. I mean, people who I think are truly living in another period of human history with many of their beliefs, but they have a much more straightforward response to information. There's a new approach to criticism on the left. I mean, maybe it's not so new, but it's the first I'm noticing it, which wants to catch you saying something that even you didn't think you meant, and hold you to this false interpretation as though they're a better judge of your own mind than you are, or that everything else you've said on the topic is. And these are people who, people like Glenn Greenwald will just ignore the plain meanings of words and just seize upon this implication that you didn't know you were making in your use of whatever term it was, which then opens the door to you being some kind of genocidal maniac or a racist or a sexist or whatever the thing is they want to find in you. But there's no amount of clarification that you can offer at that point that will convince these people that you didn't mean the thing they thought you meant when they misread you.
I agree, which is why I almost advocate not even responding at all. And I'll give one example. Mm-hmm. I once wrote an article that basically in general, not always, but in general, if you're kind to people, you can usually get more things that you want out of them than if you're unkind to people. And
right,
somebody wrote an article that basically people should put the words, if you're white, at the end of each line of James's article, which of course I would never say that. But suddenly everybody thought I had actually said that. And this woman's article got 500,000 views. And it was very kind of painful to me personally. And when I would respond to it, the few times I did respond to it, there was no arguing. Like there was nobody, everybody had already decided that was actually what I had said in my article, even without reading my article.
Yeah, it's very frustrating. It's, if this happens to you a lot, it gathers a momentum where it's a foregone conclusion because people just assume that where there's smoke, there's fire. You know, if there's this much bad stuff being said about what you said, well, then what you said had to have been bad, and I don't really have time to go follow those links and understand it in context. And it's a internet phenomenon that this is not something that really could have happened before the internet to this degree because this is just an amplification of noise that we get that you just can't get when all is happening is the people are printing books and physical newspapers. And so it is very troubling, and I think it's been very harmful to journalism in particular. I think there's a whole new standard of journalism which lacks journalistic ethics, where people do not feel constrained to understand the views they're attacking. They just if they can successfully mislead people about those views in a way that disparages them, that's considered a win for the team. If you can call someone a racist and make it stick, even if they don't have a racist bone in their body and you know it, you've succeeded if you think that their views just need to be condemned anyway.
I think journalism though in general is dead. Like you can't we can no longer as a society rely on journalism to protect us. I think it's been replaced by outrage porn on the internet and kind of catering to the outrage pornographers.
Yeah, but the problem is that there's no clear differentiation on the user side online. So if you go to a website like Salon or The Guardian, you know, those look like they're major websites. They get a lot of traffic. The Guardian is a real newspaper. So you think this is basically these are the same as the New York Times in some sense. These are all journalistic organizations. But much of what you read on those websites, in fact, virtually all of it on Salon, is just some blogger saying anything he wants about anyone without any oversight. You know, there's no fact checking. There's no conscience in many cases behind the editorial position on these articles, and so it's just you can just get lie after lie after lie amplified. I mean, I once wrote a blog post about Malala Yousafzai, who just won the Nobel Prize. This was last year when rumors of her nomination were being floated. And I wrote up a blog post totally in support of her, and I said that she was the best thing to come out of the Muslim world in 1,000 years. She deserved the Nobel Prize more than anyone I could think of. And I also said I hope she doesn't get it because it's going to massively increase her security concerns. But what I wrote was pure praise for this girl. And Salon published an article entitled "Sam Harris Slurs Malala." And then you can imagine what the blowback was on that. But it's just amazing. It's possible.
You can't do anything like that. That's
you can't do anything about it.
You can't even respond. Like even on your blog, you can't respond because then it's sort of like you fuel the fire yourself.
Well, occasionally I found that there are responses that work, that, for instance, you're catching me. This is kind of an odd interview because you're catching me just in the midst of a real hurricane of activity of this sort in my life, and I'm just getting it from all sides right now. And but so what happened yesterday is I noticed that Glenn Greenwald and Reza Aslan both retweeted something that just maliciously distorted something that I had written in my first book, The End of Faith. But it was an almost accurate quote from out of context of a discussion in The End of Faith about the nature of belief. And but the quote on its own is quite arresting and makes me look like a maniac if you don't take it in context. And so they happily didn't take it in context, even though they knew what they were doing was distorting the meaning of.
They knew that?
Well, because I've had so much back and forth with them, and I've clarified this point so many times. This is like the nuclear first strike question. I mean, they've also both circulated the rumor that I want to engage in a nuclear first strike on the Muslim world too. So this is exactly like that. It's just a different point. So they circulated this thing and attached to the phrase, they're calling me a genocidal fascist maniac. And so what I did on my blog is I took their tweet, I took the quote and put it in its original context. I excerpted a few paragraphs from my first book. And I just put it out on Twitter and Facebook. I said, look, what this is what a so-called scholar and a so-called journalist are doing, thinking they'd like you to believe that they are accurately characterizing my view here. Here's the statement in context. And I got to tell you, the level of outrage on Twitter, it was the only place I've been looking, against them has been – I've never seen anything like it. I mean, it's been just a tsunami of scorn for these two guys, much, much deserved, I would add. But I'm talking thousands upon thousands of tweets at them saying, that you've lost all credibility. And so that's the first, if we'd had this interview 48 hours ago, I might have been able to agree with you that, it's more or less hopeless to respond to these sorts of things. But I've just had the most satisfying result of a response that I've ever had, having been in this predicament for about 10 years.
I wonder if that, though, is partly a result of, this latest book, Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion, is very different from The End of Faith in that you're not making any kind of political prognostications or anything. You're actually giving a guide to spirituality. You're actually saying, this is what's worked for me to be a more spiritual and calm person, and it has nothing to do with the entire historical basis of religion. And you give kind of an outline of how other people can do it. So it's a completely different style of book, and it's more personal and more kind of helpful, as opposed to self-help. It could help the self. And I wonder if people just in general respond to that type of writing and guidance, as opposed to The End of Faith, where you're more directly attacking kind of a religious belief.
Yeah, certainly different people will. I mean, I think new readers are coming to this book who would not have been interested in some of my other books. But I've been migrating away from the mere criticism of religion for some time because I more or less have said everything that I have to say on that subject. And I have this experience of just endlessly repeating myself. And so because the truth is there's not that much to say. I mean, I've really made only three arguments in 10 years on this topic. The first is that, we have every reason to believe that our religious doctrines are almost entirely false, given that they're mutually contradictory and there's so many of them, and given all that we've learned about the universe in the last 2,000 years. So, for instance, there's just no reason to believe that any book was dictated by an omniscient being, that is the foundation of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, to just name three religions.
And a lot of people would agree with you on that.
Yeah, I mean, you have to agree. The books for those the textual claim for those three religions is just indisputable. I mean, once you give up the idea that there's anything special about this book, and you're just talking about a mediocre play by Shakespeare or some other work of literature, then there is no basis for a real commitment to Judaism and Christianity and Islam.
And this has been said for years. Like, you know, you have the Book of Jay, which discusses, you know, all the potential authorships of the Bible. I mean, the kind of the authorship of the Bible has always been in question, or at least in the past, let's say 50 years. But it's not like kind of a new thing to question the authorship of the Bible.
No. But it is fundamentally seditious of the faith orientation toward the Bible, which is, you know, once you begin to notice the contradictions and you notice that there's nothing in there that requires omniscience, and there's a lot in there that belies omniscience. You know, all these books tell us to kill homosexuals and keep slaves. You know, how much moral wisdom was required to write these books if you couldn't see that slavery was a problem?
I mean, the Bible tells the 99-year-old Abraham to basically cut off the part of the penises of every man living in his house so he could have children. So this is not like a book that anybody would write or even believe right now.
No. And what's amazing is, and people often say that, you know, there's no way, these books are so deep and wise and inscrutable, there's no way a human being could have written them. But just think of how good a book would be if it were written by the creator of the universe. I mean, if it were written by a truly omniscient being, I mean, forget about all the bad stuff in there that wouldn't be in there. It would have in it a single page about mathematics that the best mathematicians of the 21st century would still find useful. You know, it's just that there's nothing remotely like that in the Bible, and this would be true on every topic you could name. You know, we would have you know, the seed of every possible breakthrough in human understanding in that book. And of course, we have nothing of the kind. There's nothing about DNA or the germ theory of disease or information, you know, complexity theory or I mean, it's just the basis of computation. There's nothing that we can rely on now scientifically or intellectually in there apart from whatever someone in the first century could have gleaned from being in the first century. And that's a conceptual problem. But I mean, just to finish this thought, the only other things I've said about religion are, you know, one, it's likely to be untrue. Second, it is on balance harmful because it has just shattered our world into these competing religious constituencies that are in, you know, though they may be polite at the margins, they are in actually zero-sum conflict with each other because they have irreconcilable worldviews, and they feel solidarity with their tribe in a way that they don't feel solidarity with the other tribes. And we have to get past that. And the third point is just that the good things people think they get out of religion can be had in other ways and for better reasons. You can have morality without religion, and you can find reasons to go to Africa to help starving people in Somalia or people with Ebola in West Africa without believing that Jesus was born of a virgin. And many people do that. You know, it's true that Christian missionaries do good work, but then there are people with Doctors Without Borders working right alongside them doing the same kind of work without conflating it with a missionary zeal to win souls for Christ, which is often very harmful because they're doing this in areas that have been just ruined by sectarian conflict between Christians and Muslims for decades.
But let me ask you, though, because now you've gotten me scared. Like, do you think it's inevitable that an Islam nation is going to develop, you know, mid-range or even any nuclear weapons that they could aim towards, a more secular country?
Well, I don't think it's inevitable, but I think it's quite possible and even likely given our current path. I don't think that the problem of nuclear proliferation has been seized upon with the energy that it deserves, and certainly, you know, Pakistan already has nukes. They just don't have long range nukes, so, you know, they don't have the missile technology. But the missile technology is something that people are developing, and
technology can be developed eventually.
Yeah, and so it's all of this is, it's hard to uninvent things, and so everyone is getting incrementally better. And given that it's easier to break things than to fix them, everyone is getting incrementally better at developing the power to create a lot of chaos for other people. It's increasingly possible for even just one person to harm the lives of thousands or even millions of people based on the accessibility of technology and our dependence on it. I mean, just somebody who brings down the grid, you know, with a computer virus or, you know, hacks into some system and destroys, you know, the financial records of 75 million people or whatever it is, it's possible to do even society destabilizing things as a single person in a way that would have been unthinkable 200 years ago. And that's, like, I don't know that problem's going away.
It seems like the deterrent for this is going to be economic even more than spiritual or religious, though. Like, for instance, you know, you referred to mutually assured destruction before, but it's still the case that, you know, the Arab nations or Pakistan, these countries have to, you know, work economically with countries that might oppose their beliefs.
Well, that's because in most cases, the religious lunatics aren't in charge. You have people who are, you know, they may be tyrants certainly to their own people, or they may be unsavory in one way or another, but they don't want to die, and that's a big difference. So, you know, we have these secular despots, you know, many of whom have recently been overthrown, and then we have semi-religious you know, monarchies that are not really all that religious, but they pretend to be, and they export their extremism. I'm thinking of the Saudis, for instance. So these are, you know, they're rational actors. I mean, the royal family is not eager to strap on suicide vests and die. So they are quite happy to enjoy the fruits of their oil wealth, and they're trying to keep their population under control. But it is true that there are people who could well get their hands on big bombs who don't care even slightly about economics, you know. And this is, you know, I should say this again. This is not just a problem for Islam. This is a problem for Christianity and other religions. It's just there are slight differences that account for the difference we see in, you know, the religious lunatics on our side versus the religious lunatics on the Muslim side. And one difference is, many Christians, no matter how bewitched they are by their biblical literalism, are simply content for wait for Jesus to come back and sort it out. I mean, that's the expectation, is that Jesus is going to come back and rapture the good people and hurl the sinners into a lake of fire, and, you know, depending on what you believe, you know, create his 1,000-year your Reich of splendor on earth. I mean, so there's an expectation of the fulfillment of biblical prophecy of the sort you see in Revelation, for instance, which many arguably crazy Christians are waiting around to see fulfilled. But what they don't have is a doctrine of jihad. They don't have a doctrine of that makes sense of the kind of suicidal violence we see in the Muslim world, and that's a big difference. But it's you know, it's not to say that Christian beliefs can't interact with the realities of our world and the details of, like, you know, nuclear arsenals, et cetera, in ways that are terrifying. They certainly can. It's just that they tend to, it's showing up slightly differently.
So it sort of feels like, honestly, there's no avoiding this.
Well, there's no avoid. We have to get over, you know, we have to somehow effect a forward escape through this mess and come out on the other side, where we recognize that we are just part of a single sect that is humanity.
But that's not going to happen.
Well, like, no, I think it's got to happen. Otherwise, life is going to be very unpleasant in this century if it doesn't. That's really the purpose of this book. We have to get out of the religion business, and the final piece, once you're done criticizing religion for being obviously confused and at odds with what we know through science, and once you're done pointing to the harms that it causes, many of which are totally unnecessary, you have to argue that the good things people think they get out of religion can be had without believing anything, any kind of sectarian nonsense, or anything on insufficient evidence even. And one of those good things that people think they can only have in a religious context, or in a context that requires faith of some sort, is spiritual experience, is a way to value the story of someone like Jesus or the Buddha, or to value and seek and value changes in their experience that are truly remarkable and rare. Changes like, you know, loving your neighbor as yourself, or an experience of religious ecstasy. You know, so all of this all of these changes can be explored through methods like meditation or you know, methods like psychedelics or you know, there are probably other methods that are will soon be forthcoming. But we don't have to believe any lies about the divine origin of certain books to do this. And that's the crucial piece. We have to get our respect for revelation has to be retired. The idea it's amazing that it's that simple, but if you could just get past this respect we have for the idea that certain books were not produced by mere human minds, that would cancel 90% of the problem that I just discussed.
Right,
and we need a president of the United States, for instance, who will not pay lip service to the idea that certain books were probably written by the deity who created the cosmos.
But you know, my guess is your message could make its way through America and even Europe and parts of Asia. But when you get to regimes where extremists are already in control or are like you say just a coup away, they're not going to listen to your message in time for us to stop what you're suggesting could happen.
Well, the thing I'm suggesting could happen is happening in dribs and drabs anyway. I mean, we are in a state of continuous conflict with the Muslim world on many fronts, both acknowledged and unacknowledged. And we're meandering into a kind of state of continuous war.
Right, but it's
anyway.
Not a philosophical war. It's a war being
I'm saying, bombs are falling continuously, and that is something that we are now sort of used to, and most of it is out of sight and out of mind. But it's nowhere written that it's going to stay at that level forever. And but this is a real concern of mine. I'm concerned that we will, wake up one day. Forget about nuclear terrorism, which is obviously terrifying and worth taking seriously. But I mean, just think of things getting bad enough for it to be true to say that basically we're all living in Israel at this moment. I mean, that where the kind of level of concern about terrorism and the level of the encroachment against our inclination to have a truly open society, it all begins to seem like life in Israel. You know, whether you're in Kansas or in Maine or in New York City, it's all of the precautions and the stress and the reality of the possibility of daily terrorism is dialed up to the level of what it is and has been in the last decades in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. That would be horrible. That would be that I think is a real possibility. And we have to figure out how to avoid that. But it's we're not going to avoid it by lying to ourselves about the what people believe and about the link between those beliefs and the kinds of violence we're seeing in the world.
You know, it's interesting because, like, again, I don't see, as much as I see spirituality as a solution for the individual person, like, so for instance, for me to better live my life, I don't see it as a solution to the international problem of there's just nonstop bomb dropping in Afghanistan and Iraq and all these other places.
It is a solution. How we disseminate this idea is the question. But here's the issue. It's to go back to the what would seem like an esoteric point, this issue of the self and the reality of self-transcendence or the possibility of self-transcendence. This sounds like an esoteric concern, and meditation as a tool and the underlying neuroscience, all of this sounds very esoteric, but the reality is that the self is a painful illusion, and people find this pain assuaged in a variety of ways, and they can find it assuaged in ways that are benign. You can just get into surfing and experience these flow states where you're just one with the wave, and this becomes your favorite thing to do in life, and you get up every morning at 4:45 before work, and you get a couple hours in the ocean, and that's what you do. Or you can find this pain assuaged by answering the call to jihad and traveling to Syria to go fight with ISIS and experience many states of consciousness that are on their own very positive. The states like ecstasy and just, you know, more meaning than you ever felt possible in your life. And, you know, all of your personal neurosis has been shed because now you're fighting this cosmic war against evil. I mean, these are changes in consciousness that people really value. I mean, they're highly rewarding states of consciousness. But in certain cases, these states can be framed by delusional and truly dangerous and truly vile ideas, and which is certainly the case for jihadists in Syria and Iraq at the moment. And so we have to find a way of valuing these experiences and giving people access to these experiences that doesn't presuppose any sectarian nonsense. And the more we can do that, the more people can discover that it's possible to feel like Jesus without believing any of the bullshit that has been promulgated in Jesus's name for the last 2,000 years. That is something that will change. You know, I think that will change people's the respect that we have for this idea of maintaining our tribalism into the indefinite future. Because this is really the most insidious thing about even moderate religion at this moment, or even, you know, liberal religion. When it truly seems benign, when people are just doing nothing more than gather in beautiful buildings on Sundays, and there's nothing else, they have no other political commitments, they don't hate homosexuals, they're just getting together to listen to nice music in nice buildings, and they call it Christianity or they call it Judaism. What's insidious about this is that it suggests to us that there's no truly rational way to do this, that there's no way to express our solidarity with each other. There's no way to bury people when they die or to marry people when they fall in love without paying lip service to divisive myths and without being bewildered to some degree about the nature of the universe and without lying to our children just a little bit about what is true. And that we have to overcome that. And that is and religious moderates and religious liberals are not helping that process because they're protecting these myths, and they're recoiling every time somebody says something politically incorrect about the link between Islam and violence, or the link between Christianity and homophobia, or whatever it is. And we have to just ram this thing through, because on the other side of this is a truly honest conversation about everything we hold dear, and that's all we've got. We've got conversation, and you can have your conversation in 21st century terms, or you can have it in 7th century terms or in 1st century terms, and I don't know why anyone would choose the latter.
So I want to touch quickly also on your essay from 2011 called Lying. What brought up that essay for you? And you know, I've talked before on this podcast about radical honesty. Like, how do you feel about that?
Well, yeah, my honesty, if you've read the book Lying, and that essay now it's been published as a short hardcover book and an ebook as well. So it's been expanded a little bit from its original form, but it is a kind of radical honesty I'm advocating, though it may not be as, I'm not sure what you've advocated, it may not be as radical as some, in the sense that I still acknowledge the room, that there's room for tact and for concern about people's feelings, and therefore you might want to find you don't have to just blurt out everything you think like you've got, you know, some neurological condition. It's just you can pick truths that are true and useful and appropriate to communicate at the time. And there are certain circumstances where lies, or, you know, any circumstance where violence would be appropriate, well, then lying would also be appropriate. So if you need to defend yourself against an aggressor, you know, who you might otherwise hit in the face, well, then lying to that person is also appropriate. It's actually using less force than hitting them. So there's I'm not like Immanuel Kant, who thought you could never lie under any circumstances. But yeah, generally speaking, I think if you were going to make one change in your life that would simplify it and improve it and improve your relationships and make you a better person in the world, a commitment to being honest across the board is that change. It is like a superpower. And an incredibly clarifying thing to do. And what is absolutely amazing is how few people live this way. I mean, once you become this person, it's like you are rarer than a vegan. I mean, like, you know, I'm sure vegans have this experience of you know, moral clarity as well. They walk through the world, you know, just being amazed at how many people are sort of needlessly killing and eating things, and participating in an industry that does that. But you know, once you commit to being radically honest across the board with friends and strangers, you just all around you see the evidence of people just ruining their reputations and their relationships and just needlessly complicating their lives by lying. And it's quite amazing to see. And I you know, that this was something that happened to me in my freshman year at Stanford. There was a course taught by this professor who's still there, Ron Howard, who just taught a brilliant course on whether it's ever ethical to lie. And that my book is really based on the results of having taken that course when I was 18 years old.
But you know, also I wanted to ask you. You mentioned in your book, and this is a little more esoteric, but you mentioned in Waking Up about the case of Ramana Maharshi, where he basically was this young man in the late 1800s who had this experience of feeling like he was dead, or wondering what it was like to be dead. And then from that moment on, he sort of reached this almost permanent state of mindfulness. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you think that sort of thing is again, something that was an accident or something that could be kind of developed.
Well, I certainly think it could be developed. I mean, that's what the practice is, to develop it. But the in his case, it was an accident, for lack of a better word. It was something that was not preceded by any kind of effort or interest on his part. So it just came out of the blue. And as you say, it did seem to be somewhat, it basically seemed permanent, even though I think there was some time course over which his experience evolved once that awakening happened. But yeah, he, you know, he's the poster boy for, you know, sudden and unlooked for enlightenment. I mean, it just came upon him out of nowhere. And that, you know, there's some testimony to that happening to people in the literature, but for the most part, it happens to people who spend a fair amount of time and effort looking into the nature of their own minds and scrutinizing this thing we call the self more and more closely.
Well, it makes me think of the woman who wrote the book A Stroke of Insight, where it's almost like what happens in certain strokes, where you suddenly become detached to kind of the thoughts and experiences around you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you can have a stroke. There's no question that the nervous system can be perturbed in a variety of ways, which through illness or injury or drugs or crisis or stress, where you can have these transient experiences that are unusual and maybe very pleasant, but that's not really the center of the bullseye in terms of spiritual practice or you know, the goal of meditation. I mean, the thing that you really want to discover, or you know, for which meditation is a tool to discover, is that no matter what the experience is, no matter what its character, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, whether it's psychedelic or you know, far more ordinary, that consciousness, the sense of that there's a self in the middle of consciousness appropriating experience in each moment, that's an illusion, and you can cut through that illusion. And cutting through it has some very good consequences. And so that's, you know, that's the goal, and there are many interesting experiences you have on the way to that goal. You can just paying attention to anything closely in a meditative way can change your feeling in rather extraordinary ways. So you can feel rapture and bliss and all kinds of, you know, classically seemingly spiritual states of mind that are transient in meditation. They come and go, and they're based on the having been very concentrated for a period of time. But it's not the goal can't really be about always feeling bliss or always feeling rapture, because you can't always feel any one thing. Things just come and go, and the goal is to be truly at peace with the comings and goings of all phenomenon.
Well, Sam, I really appreciate everything you've said on this podcast, including scaring me to death about Islamic nuclear holocaust. But in particular, though, I really enjoyed waking up, and I really do think there is a guide to spirituality without religion. There is a way to kind of experience sort of more inner peace and calmness by using many of these techniques that you advocate. So I think it's a very useful book for people to read. Again, I appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. It's great to meet you by phone, and hope our paths cross at some point in the future.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks again.
Yeah, thanks, James.
Bye, Sam.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.